To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. A bit on the romantic side, as we would expect from Emily Dickinson. Dave Goulson, biological environmental scientist and professor and the man when it comes to knowing the bumblebee, tells a fuller story in his book, A Sting in the Tail. And as he writes equally from the intellect as well as his personal adventures, he educates and invites us, the citizen scientists of the world, to join the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Congratulations are in order first here, Dave, as your book, A Sting in the Tail, is lauded as one of the best books of 2014, and stating that it will alter the way we think about bumblebees. But I would say simply that it will get us thinking about bumblebees, which will lead to not only a curiosity, but a conservation action as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if people don't know about things, they don't care about them, and really all my main aim in writing it was just to get people interested. You know, there's all this really fascinating stuff right under our noses, and we don't pay much attention to it. You know, it's striking how, and if you watch sort of wildlife documentaries on the television, you know, they're always focused on exotic animals in far-flung places, and it's all big stuff, you know, rhinos and lions and whatever.
Right.
And there's all this amazing stuff right under our noses that's actually much more relevant to us, you know, and particularly bees, obviously, because they pollinate our crops and so on. And yet, very largely, you know, people are staggeringly sort of ignorant. I don't mean that in a rude way, but they you know, they just go through their lives without noticing all this stuff that's happening all around.
I know. Well, not only not noticing, but I am hugely ignorant on a lot of this information, you know, knowing generic basics, but I so appreciated learning all of these things mentioned in your book that, you know, I'm reading along and learning facts, and then all of a sudden I find myself laughing out loud because of the way you're able to write and sharing your own personal experiences. So it's not just a factual book about the bee, but also your life in studying them. And I certainly appreciated how you put in there things that just did not work, and you know, you weren't ashamed, and I love that, because that's the only way we learn, obviously. And
yeah, and I think science is often I don't know, misunderstood, and people don't realize that they imagine scientists as these sort of geeky, nerdy people in white coats, often doing weird and sometimes unpleasant things to animals in labs, and actually, you know, a lot of science isn't really like that at all. And it's quite a kind of creative process. You know, you have ideas and you try and follow them through, and they sometimes work and sometimes they go horribly wrong, as I describe in the book. But that's kind of all part of the fun of it. And I tried to kind of get that across, that actually, you know, science isn't boring stuff that goes on in labs necessarily. It can be just kind of great fun, and certainly studying bees, you know, it's kept me occupied for the last 20-odd years, and no doubt will keep me going until I retire and beyond.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there are so many facets to draw you in. Some, and maybe many, may not realize how gentle the bumblebee is, and I'm wondering if you can just share some of the particulars about the bumblebee before we move on into your efforts in conservation.
Oh, it's hard to know where to start, actually, with bumblebees. I mean, they're a lot of people sort of confuse their bees, and I think an awful lot of people out there think there is just one species of bee, you know, it lives in a box and it makes honey and is looked after by beekeepers. But if you ask people to draw a bee, they'll draw something that's big and round and has yellow and black stripes, so that what the sort of cartoon bee is a bumblebee. And obviously the thing that lives in a box is the honeybee. And they're very different creatures. The bumblebees are very loath to sting. You know, you can actually dig up their nests if you're quite sort of reasonably gentle about it. And they won't even sting you then, you know, they'll just sort of sit there looking frightened, and they have this rather endearing habit of raising their middle leg and waving it at you when they're frightened. I've never worked out why, but that's what they do. And you know, they live out their lives completely unhelped or unaided by man. They've been pollinating our crops for millennia. And some crops in particular are pollinated by bumblebees rather than other things. So for example, pretty much every tomato that anyone has eaten for the last about 30 years was almost certainly pollinated by a bumblebee rather than any other species of bee. So they're really useful, and they're just fascinating, endearing rather large as insects go, furry creatures that anyone can see. So one of the kind of things I always think is rather nice about working with bumblebees is they are everyday creatures that you know, sadly not at this time of year, but in a couple of months' time, you know, you've only got to go out in your local garden or park, pretty much anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere, and you'll see these things buzzing around going about their business.
Yeah, and I found it so fascinating about their temperature that they keep, and the caloric intake and flight is, you know, their...
Yeah. They're one of the sort of really unusual things about bumblebees is that they are really good at flying in cold weather. You know, most insects are warmth-loving. They're much more abundant. There are many more species of, say, butterfly or dragonfly or grasshopper in the tropics than there are in kind of temperate areas. But bumblebees are the opposite. They actually thrive in cold weather, and they have this sort of ability to keep themselves warm internally. They generate lots of heat by flapping their flight muscles. And they're big and they're furry, which keeps the heat in. And so they can fly around when the air temperature is below freezing, which virtually no other insect can do. But it does come at a cost. You know, they burn energy at a terrific rate. And the analogy I use in the book is that a running man burns the calories in a Mars bar in which I think you have in your side of the Atlantic. In about an hour of running, which is kind of, you know, depressing if you're running to run off that moment of weakness when you ate a chocolate bar. But if you happen to be a man-sized bumblebee, which would be pretty exciting, then you'd burn off those calories in 30 seconds of flying. So they need to eat constantly. They need loads of sugary, nectar-rich flowers. And that sort of brings me, I guess, to the problems they often face in the modern world, in that there just aren't many flowers these days, and we can all do something to help there.
Yeah, and I just, in particular, noticed how perfectly their whole system was set up, you know, whereas a man can eat the bar and have another one and another one and sit on the chair and watch the football game or whatever. But with bees, in order to keep their temperature to stay alive, they need to eat the calories, and then they need to fly to keep their temperature and everything. So it's just quite a brilliant little system.
Yeah, there's no danger of them getting fat. They burn it off. They need it all, you know, need that energy to keep them going. And they're always, so even when they've got a full stomach, they're only 40 minutes from being starving, basically. So,
right.
They kind of live their life on a bit of a knife edge, really.
Yes. Is there anything about their societal structure that you wish humans would replicate, or perhaps you're glad that we don't replicate?
Well, so it's funny. I mean, people have sort of idealized social insects over the millennia. I mean, people used to say that they were sort of a perfect society, a harmonious society where there's no conflicts and all the bees work together in their sort of common goal. And a lot of the time that is true. So for most of the bumblebee sort of life cycles, right through the spring, there's just the queen bee and her daughters, the workers. And the workers are completely selfless. They devote themselves to just helping their mother produce more offspring. So it's a bit like a convent in a way. You've got all these sterile worker, the female, they're all females, they're all sisters. So this great group of sisters looking after their mum, and everything is wonderful. But actually later in the season, it all goes horribly wrong, and there are many things that we really wouldn't want to emulate at all. So once when the queen starts producing male eggs, the workers, it's not in their interests. It's actually, this is all rather complicated, and I desperately tried to explain this simply in the book, but they have really weird genetics, which underlies this behaviour. But the long and the short of it is, when the queen starts producing sons, which they have to do in the summer, the nest kind of becomes a bit chaotic. The workers start laying their own eggs and producing their own sons, and they start eating the queen's sons, so their brothers. They're basically eating their brothers, and the queen fights back and eats her grandsons. So it all ends up in a big scrap, in a big kind of fight in the nest, and eventually sometimes the queen actually gets killed by her own daughters. So there are aspects of it which we might want to copy, but we certainly wouldn't want to take that too far.
No, I had a funny thought that maybe spinster sisters are reincarnated bumblebees.
Maybe they are.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Dave, about pollinating, and what are some basics that seem to be perhaps not known, and maybe a historic fact or two about it is important to bring in now.
Well, I mean, so bees have been pollinating flowers for about 120 million years. They evolved, long before man was around. In fact, when dinosaurs roamed the earth was when bees first appeared. And they kind of co-evolved with flowers. The bees and flowers go hand in hand. That a flower is there to attract bees and other insects to pollinate the plant. And to this day, the majority of plants on Earth are pollinated by mainly by bees, but some by other insects. And so we wouldn't have flowers, be they wildflowers or crop flowers, without bees. So roughly 80% of all the plants in the world are pollinated by insects. And of the crops we grow, about 75%, so of all the different things we grow to eat, three-quarters of them need pollinating by insects, and it's, again, usually bees. And that only actually, slightly confusingly, that was only results in about a third of the food we eat by volume, because the bulk of our diet comes from wind pollinated things like wheat and barley and corn and rice globally, which don't need bees. But the third that does come from bee pollinated plants is all the nice stuff, all the fruit and vegetables. So, if it weren't for bees, we wouldn't have strawberries, tomatoes, chilies, raspberries, blackberries, blueberries, beans, and so on. I could go on for ages and ages. So essentially our diets would be awful if it weren't for bees. We'd be living on rice and bread and porridge, basically.
Yeah. Is there a ratio of what the bumblebee pollinates and the honeybee pollinates?
So what many people don't appreciate is just how many species of bee there are. And they're all important for different crops. So there are over 22,000 species of bee in the world. So it isn't just honeybees and bumblebees. It's actually honeybees, bumblebees, and then this enormous number of other bees. And they're all out there. They all visit crops. They all pollinate to varying extents. And different bees tend to be good at pollinating different flowers. So almonds, for example, about 80% of all the almonds in the world are grown in Northern California, just in this one place. And they're almost entirely pollinated by honeybees. Most of the honeybees in North America are taken to California for the almond flowering in early spring. So that's an example of a crop that is pretty much just honeybees. But then if you look at, say, squashes, they tend to be pollinated by, there's a thing called the squash bee, which is a different species of bee that tends to live in farmland and only really visits squashes. Bumblebees are really good at pollinating things like blueberries and cranberries and tomatoes. So one of the tricks that bumblebees have is they can do a thing called buzz pollination. So tomatoes and their relatives like potatoes and so on They have these really weird flowers. They don't look particularly exciting, but to get the pollen to come out of them and to pollinate them, they have to be vibrated. It's a bit like if you imagine that the anthers, the bits that produce the pollen, are a bit like an upturned pepper pot. So, and it has to be shaken to get the pollen to fall out the little holes at the bottom. Mm. And a bumblebee does that by it grabs the flower with its mandibles, and then it buzzes its flight muscles, vibrates its flight muscles, and shakes its whole body and the flower, and catches the pollen as it pops out the hole at the bottom. Honeybees never worked out how to do this, clever though they are in other ways. So if you want your tomatoes pollinating, honeybees are absolutely useless. And so almost all tomato pollination is done by bumblebees. In fact, there are factories that rear bumblebee nests for sale to tomato growers in the big commercial ones that grow tomatoes in greenhouses. They rely entirely on bumblebees. Depending on which crop you're growing, you tend to need different bees. So that I guess the important conclusion to take home from that is we need to look after all of our bees, not just, you know, make sure the honeybees are okay or the bumblebees are okay, but actually make sure the whole lot of them are doing okay, because they all have their jobs to play.
Yes, well, I know you've studied in depth sustainable pollination, and you know, you just mentioned that we have basically factory nest growing of the bumblebee for tomato growers. What are your findings? Is this working? Or I know that a lot of the bees that get hauled from one place to the other, those brought to the almond plantations or farms over in California, for instance, those are the bees that seem to be hurting.
Yeah, there are problems with factory farming of anything. The honeybees, particularly in North America, they have this really weird and stressful lifestyle where they're moved around the country from you know, one coast to the other. They go from the citrus in Florida to the almonds of California to the blueberry fields of Maine or whatever. Or, you know, so they're doing thousands of miles a year on the backs of lorries, and then you know they have this very unnatural diet where for a month they've got nothing to eat but almond pollen, and then the next month they're eating whatever it might be. And, you know, if you imagine yourself, if you spent your whole life being stuck in a box on a lorry, and when you got out you had to spend a month eating, let's say, turnips, and then the next month you had nothing to eat but chocolate, then you probably wouldn't be feeling too good. And on top of that, there are issues with pesticides. So when these crops are obviously treated with insecticides, and that certainly doesn't help the matters. So the poor bees, they've got this weird, stressful lifestyle. They've got a rather awful diet. They're exposed to toxins. It's probably not surprising that honeybees are looking a little peaky at times, and there have been a lot of problems in recent years with colonies dying.
Yes, and it becomes known as the genetic bottleneck. Yes?
Well, so the lots of terms that are sort of batted around. People talk about colony collapse disorder as this sort of mysterious disappearing bee syndrome, which caught the media's attention a couple of years ago, which was where colonies, just essentially all the adult bees disappeared. They didn't die, or at least they didn't die in the hive. And we still aren't 100% sure what that was all about. And it's a combination of factors. I mean, the genetic bottleneck idea is one that essentially the commercial bees are often rather inbred. They haven't got much of the natural genetic diversity that might help them to fight, for example, diseases. But collectively, it's this combination of stresses that we throw at our bees. And it's not just honeybees, but obviously wild bees have to put up with many of the same pressures. You know, the modern farmland is not a very friendly place for wildlife. You know, there are a few natural flowers. There might occasionally be a crop that comes into flower, but for the rest of the year, there's not very much. There are lots of pesticides being used. There's not many places for wild bees to nest.
Right.
And so generally, you know, life is pretty stressful for bees, and obviously because we depend on them, then that should really worry us, and we need to take steps to sort it out and give them a slightly easier life if we can.
Right. So as with most or perhaps all things, variety is a spice of life. And I know you have a farm in France, and I'd love to hear what's going on with that. But I wonder, are there any California almond growers, perhaps, that you're aware of that might grow clover under the trees or something? That would seem like a good idea.
Well, certainly there's lots of potential for putting flowers back into farmland one way or another. And clovers is a really good idea. I mean, I don't know if any almond farmers are doing that. But in the UK here, we've been trying to work with apple growers to integrate putting legumes like clovers in, growing them under the trees. And the bees absolutely love clovers, as I guess everybody knows. They produce really protein-rich pollen that's really nutritious for the bees. But they also fix nitrogen, and so they boost the soil fertility.
Yes.
So, and yet, at present, most orchards are grown with just bare herbicided ground beneath the trees. And I really think that we need to kind of look at intercropping and more mixed farming, finding ways to put a bit of diversity back into farmland. I'm really not convinced that they're sustainable in the long term.
Yes, I have a great little trivia for you about red clover. I was reading this history that this woman who lived to be about 100 years old, and she was one of the first white people in California. And she said every year when the clover bloomed, she could see the Indians literally on their bellies eating the clover.
I've never heard that. Wow. I mean, it certainly produces sweet nectar, but I've never heard of people consuming it before.
Tell us about your farm in France.
This is now 11 years ago. I bought a run-down old farm. It's just a farmhouse, and sits in the middle of a big meadow. It was a wheat field, 33 acres, so it's very small by farm scale. And I've been trying to basically turn it into a wildflower meadow. So one of the sort of big things that has hurt bumblebee populations in particular has been the loss of flowery grasslands. And certainly in Europe, we had hay meadows, which for centuries had just been cut for hay, and they were very rich in flowers. But they were all kind of swept away in the 20th century. They were replaced by silage fields. In a sense, similar things have happened in North America, where you used to have vast tracts of prairie. And so that was really bad for bees, because they lost this flower-rich grassland that they absolutely love. So what I'm trying to do down in France is recreate a patch of that, and learn, and also sort of learn how best to do it, in the hope that maybe I can persuade other people to have a go as well. Recreating one of those meadows that you know took hundreds of years naturally to create is not easy. And the biggest problem is that soil had been fertilized for the arable crops that were grown on it before I owned it. And that high soil fertility is good for growing crops, but it means that grasses grow really tall and thick and lush. And they just smother everything else. So when I got the field, it was just a bright green field of dense grass, very little diversity, no flowers for bees. The challenge is, how do you get rid of that fertility? And unless you can do that, then you'll never get the flowers back. The cheapest way to do it is just to harvest the hay, which is what people did historically. Every time you take the hay away, you just take some of the nutrients away. And very, very slowly, the flowers come back. I've been experimenting with other ways of speeding it up. There are certain types of flower that are parasitic on grasses that I've been sowing in little patches in the meadows. The lovely flower called yellow rattle, which bees actually love the flowers of anyway, that seems to accelerate the process by basically suppressing those vigorous grasses and leaving a little more room for other flowers to creep in.
I know relocating the bumblebees been a big project of yours. There were bees that went down to New Zealand, and then you tried to bring them back, and then in the meanwhile you discovered that there were some in southern Sweden that might be more easily relocated. And I'm wondering where you're at with that now. It was a big expense. It didn't work out so well bringing them back from New Zealand. Is it ever a moral issue, man playing God or anything like that?
We play God all the time, unfortunately. I mean, the whole world is so influenced by what we do. Certainly in somewhere like Britain, you can't find any habitat that isn't man-made. Mm. So I'm not sure there's any sort of logic to saying, oh, we shouldn't interfere. We've already interfered with everything. And so this story of the short-haired bumblebee, it basically is one of it was a native British species. It went extinct in the 1980s because of loss of the flowery habitats it used to live in. But by this sort of weird quirk of fate, some bumblebees were taken from Britain to New Zealand in 1895 to pollinate clover, and so there are descendants of the short-haired bumblebee alive and well in New Zealand to this day, which is as far as I know, might be a unique situation where a species is extinct in its country of origin, but that descendants of that population still exist elsewhere on the other side of the world. So it seemed like a really cool idea to try and reintroduce them back to Britain. And that's essentially where we started from. But then we did genetic studies of these New Zealand bees and found that they were terribly inbred, that actually you can do some sort of calculations to estimate what the probable number of founding bees taken out to New Zealand was, and we think it was about 2 for this species. So the whole population in New Zealand is descended from 2 queens, we think. And so it genetically is really weird, and they probably wouldn't be able to cope back in Europe, where one of the reasons they probably survived in New Zealand is there are very few bee diseases in New Zealand. They escaped, they left behind bumblebee diseases. So even though they've got no genetic diversity, they can survive there, but we don't think they'd probably survive back here. So we're now reintroducing them from Sweden, and so for the last 3 years we've brought queen short-haired bumblebees from Sweden and released them in the southeast of England, in Kent, and we've created lots of new habitat for them. It seems as if we might be getting somewhere. The project is going to run for at least another 2 years, we hope, releasing queens every spring, and we'd love to reach the point where we don't need to bring any more in, and where we see a resident population of these bees back in England.
Yes, I have no doubt that's going to happen.
One of the great things is that everyone can help, be it children in schools or people in their back gardens. Almost everybody has access to a little patch of land, whether, you know, either their garden or their school grounds or whatever, where they can plant flowers to help bees. And it is as simple as that. You know, there are lots of flowers that are easy to grow. As soon as they start to flower, wherever you are, in the middle of a city, wherever in the world, bees will find them and feed on them and benefit from them. It really does lend itself to getting schools involved. And in fact, we've got a project we're starting this year with schools in the UK, where we're getting schools to do a little. Actually, it's a little experiment in a sense that we want them to grow some different vegetable crops and do some pollination experiments to see whether they've got enough bees in their schoolyard to properly pollinate their crops. So it actually kind of is educational, but it gets the kids thinking about, you know, the importance of bees and looking at them down on their hands and knees, watching bees visiting flowers and so on.
Dave Goulson's book is A Sting in the Tail. You can find him at bumblebeeconservationtrust.org. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is at iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.